Welcome to Barista Broadcast. Here's Clark.
This third discussion of our three-part introductory series on coffee will cover coffee as a commodity and trade. As coffee houses grew in number and popularity, demand for the bean escalated wildly. Coffee quickly became the highly valued and traded commodity it remains today. Like all objects of desire, coffee has brought out the best and worst in us. The history of coffee as a commodity is a tale of politics, romance, espionage, perilous ocean voyages, underhand dealings, noble theft, wealth and poverty, slavery, and revolt. There are heroes and villains to spare, each worthy of a closer look. But for now, let's try to take the big picture. In 1700, Europe consumed 500,000 pounds of coffee a year. By the turn of the century, consumption had reached 100 million pounds a year. Until the end of the 17th century, Arabia was the world's sole supplier of coffee, and all beans would be sterilized or roasted before leaving the Arab world to ensure no one could grow a coffee plant outside the Muslim nations. The demand pressure on such tightly controlled production naturally increased until it reached a breaking point, and it was the Dutch who made the break. Having gained control of the spice route, they brought cuttings from the east and successfully grew coffee plants in Amsterdam's greenhouses. In 1690, the Dutch East India Company set up coffee plantations at Batavia in Java, now Indonesia. Arabian coffee was still thought to be better, but the Arabs soon lost control of the market, since coffee from Java sold for less and shipped directly. Once coffee was liberated from the exclusive control of Arabia, it was bound to travel far and wide. A single plant brought at great hazard to the island of Martinique thrives where it's planted and changes the course of history. All coffee in Latin America descends from that one plant. In Europe, coffee inspired the age of reason and democracy. In the Americas, an age of colonialism and slavery. The French established large plantations in the New World to cultivate the precious bean. In 1790, half of the world's coffee was grown and harvested by African slaves on the single island of Saint Domingo, now Haiti, under horrendous conditions. In 1792, Toussaint Louverture, the Black Napoleon, led the slaves in a successful revolt that unfortunately resulted in the destruction of nearly all the coffee and sugar plantations. The struggle lasted a dozen years, and the economy of Haiti never truly recovered. It became the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Fertile berries smuggled into Brazil set the stage for the entrance of the coffee barons into Brazil and Latin American history. Coffee and its barons ate up the countryside at an amazing rate, and today, only 10% of the original Brazilian rainforest exists. As in Haiti, Brazilian coffee production was dependent on slave labor. So great was the counterpressure from the profits and political control of the coffee barons, Brazil was the last country to abandon slavery. All across Latin America, the story was always the same. In Guatemala, government enacted forced labor laws, and to this day, controversy persists over coffee-growing conditions and fair labor practices. The sad fact is, coffee production has always been oppressive, with the second and third worlds providing cheap production for the industrialized first world. Today, there are 70 different countries that grow coffee. Some of the countries reliant on coffee as a significant portion of their GDP are, in order of largest production, Brazil, Vietnam, Colombia, Indonesia, and Mexico. But the influence has gone both ways. The boom and bust cycles in coffee trading, fueled by speculation, start as early as 1880, and the bust in coffee in 1929 was a significant factor in the Wall Street crash. In 1941, 42, and 1943, the United States underwrote the entire Brazilian coffee crop to forestall a Latin American alliance with Nazi Germany. The war years also brought coffee rationing to the home front and powdered coffee for the troops. Being frugal with coffee was patriotic, and quality took a back seat to making sure the Red Cross and the USO had plenty of hot Joe for the boys in uniform. Post-war America was in love with suburbia, and the suburban home was all about the deluxe and innovative appliances. Coffee itself was eclipsed by the deluxe percolators in which it was made, and Madison Avenue made sure any inferior taste would be chalked up to an inferior housewife, not an inferior blend of beans. Post-war cultural marketing and political forces, unfortunately, had the effect of leaving the United States in a coffee dark ages. With the rise of the corporation and expansion of interstate commerce, the American retail coffee market came to be dominated by a handful of major labels, while smaller roasters were pushed out of business. The rapid post-war development of suburbs led to grocery franchises like the Atlantic and Pacific, or A&P, who made distribution difficult for small to medium-sized coffee roasters. And there is big money in coffee. Procter & Gamble's Folgers brand, sold to J.M. Smucker's The Jam Company in late 2008, holds the largest share of the U.S. market, around 24%, and increased Smucker's profits by 19%. Maxwell House, now a Kraft Foods subsidiary, retains the second largest share, about 16%. These two companies gross around $900 million to $1 billion in annual coffee sales. Both brands use Robusta beans as the mainstay of their blend. Folgers and Maxwell House, along with Sanka and a few others, have long represented coffee in the United States. Of course, we are a nation of immigrants, and there were always some ethnic cafes and home coffee, and as cultural and ethnic diversity gained in value, and communication and travel became easier and cheaper, Americans began to look to the other cuisines and customs, and coffee was part of that exploration. The sophisticated mid-century host prepared Scandinavian-style clear coffee with a Chemex, and the cosmopolitan diner finished his meal with an espresso. College students came back from backpacking in Europe with a taste for café au lait and croissants, and the middle-class percolator gave way to the Melitta filter drip. Then came the age of tech. And with the tech boom, first Northern California, then Seattle, came to be the new coffee meccas. Coffee was the perfect drink for the age of reason because it could sustain clear thought and expression for hours. Tech wizards were looking for that same lightning in a cup and sought out coffee as the drink of the new age of tech. The American age of technology grew up with the new American coffee culture, and once again it was a Dutchman who brought coffee to a larger audience. Alfred Peet, a native of the Netherlands, started his specialty roaster and shop in Berkeley in 1966. The three founders of Seattle Starbucks bought all their coffee from Peet for their first year in business in 1971. Eventually, Jim Baldwin, one of Starbucks' founders, returned to Peet's, and Howard Schultz took the helm of Starbucks. The two companies agreed not to compete with each other, and now they are both going strong, although Peet's has remained the much smaller company. During the same period, Jim Stewart started what would become Seattle's Best Coffee at the Wet Whisker on Whidbey Island. Stewart roasted his own and sold 500 pounds of coffee in his second year in business Stewart Brothers later set up shop in Pike's Place Market in Seattle and became Seattle's Best, and after a series of ownership changes, became a subsidiary of Starbucks. Starbucks closed Seattle's Best Coffee's historic Vashon Island Roastery building, but Stewart's original 1952 roaster and roastmaster Peter Larson have carried on as the Vashon Island Coffee Roastery. Starbucks, though now the largest coffee house company in the world, still holds only about 12% of the American coffee market. The pros and cons of Starbucks make for a fertile area of discussion, and we will explore that in full in future podcasts. But it's good to remember Starbucks helped America to see the benefits of better coffee. This is considered, retroactively, American second wave coffee. Now, centuries after its European cousins and Latin neighbors, the United States is at last ready for even better coffee and open to third wave coffee houses, where they serve the really grown-up stuff. Stumptown, Intelligentsia, Blue Bottle, Ritual Roaster, and Four Barrel are a few of the more popular brands. And in keeping with the American inclination to do it yourself, there's been an increase in home coffee enthusiasts too. It is estimated that 2 billion cups of coffee are consumed daily around the globe. Hard to imagine the United States and the world without it. We have come a long way, and yet, the more things change, look around the coffee house, we see people using the cafe as a second living room, engaging with friends, books, or music, as a satellite office, working, meeting with a client in person or electronically, as a second kitchen settled in with a newspaper, a half-empty mug on the table with a warm croissant. It's home away from home and the public square, all rolled into one. And it is my job and my pleasure as a barista to give you, distilled into every cup, the best of coffee history, science, and romance, and of course the caffeine and those over 800 delicious volatiles. Next time you visit, we will be joined by professionals and experts in the various fields of physiology and health, history and culture, trade and commodity.